Hi, everyone. We are back for another episode of the Howe & Stein Center's podcast series, Off the Stage, and it is the first of the 2023-2024 academic year. My name is Maddie Miller. I'm the media specialist for the Howe & Stein Center, and a new thing we're going to do for this academic year is having a third person on the podcast, and today I have my colleague, Kaylor Sweeney, who is the Common Ground Program Manager at the Howe & Stein Center. Kaylor, thanks for hopping in.
Thanks for bringing me on, Maddie.
And today our guest is one of our speakers at our very first event on September 7th. We are welcoming historian and author Victor Davis Hanson. Dr. Hanson, thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
We are going to start off the episode today with something we always start all of our episodes with, which is our famous BOQ, which stands for Bowl of Questions. And these are just questions that were submitted actually from our followers on social media. So if you are listening and you want to submit a question for future speakers on the podcast, you can follow us on social media at the Howe & Stein Center GVSU. But Dr. Hanson, since this is a virtual interview, you obviously don't have an actual bowl to pick out the questions from. Sure. So instead, I'll just read you two questions.
Okay, sounds good.
So the first question was actually submitted by one of our student workers, Georgia, and she asked, what is the best advice you've ever received?
Don't speak up unless you know something. And try to listen more than you talk. That was advice by my grandparents, I think, and my mother, who was happened to be a lawyer. So
that's awesome. That's good advice.
That was good advice. Yeah.
That's great. Love to hear it. Our next question is, are you a podcast listener? And if so, what is one of your favorite shows you listen to?
Well, I also do 4 podcasts a week. So
you're familiar.
Yes, I have to do, and they're about an hour and 20 minutes, so it's almost 6 hours a week. I like a variety. Sometimes I listen to Joe Rogan. Sometimes I listen, I'm on and I listen to Megyn Kelly. Mm-hmm. I've listened to Jordan Peterson. But during the day, I have to write 2 columns a week, and then I write for my website, and I'm working on a book. So when you do, and I have a full-time job, it's hard for me to find the time. And so I sometimes listen to podcasts and read a column of someone's at the same time.
Yeah.
And so that's helpful. I also try sometimes to listen to what people are saying with whom I don't agree. And that can be NPR or The Bulwark or people like that, just to see what the oppositional argumentation is. Something like that.
That's awesome. That's a good practice to just have a well-rounded perspective of things that are going on.
It is.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for answering those questions. We're going to get into just kind of some questions that I came up with. Okay. So first, I would love to just hear kind of about the very beginning for you, Dr. Hanson. So just tell us a little bit about where you grew up, what you were like in grade school, and like what some of your interests and hobbies were when you were growing up.
Well, I'm speaking from where I was born, in a farmhouse right in the center of California, about halfway between Visalia, California and Fresno, California, 3 hours from Los Angeles and 3 hours from San Francisco, and about 40 minutes from the Sierra Nevada mountain. So we had about 180 acres. And then my sibling moved away, as everybody did in small farming. And I don't know why I didn't, but I'm still here. So I have a remnant or a vestigial 42 acres. And then I have the house that my great-great-grandmother built in 1870. And so I am constantly working on that house to keep it viable, although I don't know if my 2 children want to move out here or not. They have pretty committed lives elsewhere in California. And my hobbies, like I said, I run a program at the Hoover Institution that has about 9 employees and visiting professors in it, maybe 11 actually this year. So that's kind of a full-time job, and it's 180 miles away. So it takes me 3 or 4 hours to drive there, and then I have an apartment. So for 2 or 3 days a week, I'm on the Stanford campus, and I try to coordinate. So I do about a 9 to a 12 hour day there, 3 days a week, and then I drive back here. It takes about 4 hours, and then I write here on the farm, but I try to, I have five dogs, and it's still outside of the city limits. It's getting closer, but still outside. So, and we have a 42 acres of almond orchard. And so I check and I rent it out. And so I watch the renter. I talk to them. I, you know, every night I walk about 2 miles, not only around my place, but where we used to own, but now have investors or corporations bought it, but I still walk on. And so, and then my hobbies, I have a little place in the Sierra Nevada mountains, about 75 miles away at 7,200 feet. And you can imagine this year with the snow, we had about 90 feet of snow cumulative. So I've been going up every weekend and fixing damages all the way into August, and I'm still not done. The snow, you couldn't even see the house until May 1st. It was like an igloo, and it's a two-story house. You could walk from the ground on a slope up above the second story. So the central Sierra Nevada is the highest part of the Sierra. And, you know, Kaiser Peak is right near there, almost 11,000 feet. You know, Whitney's to the south at 14,000. And so it gets a lot of snow. So I've been working on that, but it's a beautiful place. So I go up there on weekend. I want a vacation and write, but it seems that this year all I'm doing is working on the house, whether repainting or plastering or fixing shingles or redoing brickwork that was ice and stuff.
Yeah, you'll get there one day, hopefully.
I hope so.
Awesome. Well, thanks for sharing those. That's so cool to hear a little bit more about that. One of my favorite things to ask about on this podcast is just people in their educational journey. I just think it's really interesting to see kind of how people started their career, especially with that undergrad degree and then all of the degrees that come later and whatnot. So first, I'd love to just hear about how you chose where you went to school for undergrad. Like, did you focus more on like location or culture, you know, college visits and whatnot? I'd just love to hear. And then also what you studied.
Well, I came from a farming background, so they're very practical. And they had just opened a new University of California campus at Santa Cruz. And when I graduated from high school, I think it was 3 or 4 years old. And that was kind of the place to be in that period because it was a new experimental, beautiful campus right on the Pacific Ocean. Everybody wanted to go there. But I had a twin brother and an older brother. And my parents thought it would be economical that we all went to the same place. And then we could drive over together and back. And we went over and then we actually bought a little house for, I think it was $22,000. I remember our mortgage was $150 a month, which was a lot. So we had renters and I think there were six guys in this little house. But I didn't know what I was interested in because I'd gone to a very rural high school, a small town of 5,500 people. And the high school was not competitive with the type of students who went to Stanford, UCLA or Caltech or the UC campuses. So I had to really work. And I met a very good professor there who was the preceptor. And I took a class in Western Civ and I did very well. And he came to me and said, you know, I don't know. You write very well for a kid from the farm, even though I had just turned 18. Have you ever thought of taking Latin and Greek? And I said, absolutely not. I don't want to do that. But he said, try it. And so I went to Yale University for the summer of my and took an intensive graduate course. I was 18 and everybody was in their mid-20s or early 30s. It was kind of daunting. I'd never really studied classical languages at all. So when I came back, then I did pretty well in Latin and Greek, and I spent a year in Greece at a program. And then my advisors, I got to know three or four good classes. I had a wonderful classics department, believe it or not. They had brought a lot of the Yale faculty to UC Santa Cruz. And it was kind of the end of the 60s, so it was kind of wild, socially and culturally left-wing. A lot of drugs, unfortunately, a lot of protests. Vietnam War was winding down, but it was still culturally edgy. And classics was kind of a refuge for somebody from a farm. I just wanted to keep away from all that. So I studied a lot. And then I thought my mom, who had gone to Stanford as an undergraduate and graduate, wanted me to go to law school like she had. She went to law school there. But these two professors said, you know Latin and Greek pretty well, and I think you could get your whole way paid for. And so I applied. I didn't know what I should do. So I thought I'd make my mom and dad happy by going to Stanford, but I didn't want to go to law school. I went to the PhD program in classics, and they paid the entire way. And then I lived in Greece a year and a half to do research when I was a graduate student, the American School of Classical Studies. And then I came home at 25, and there were no jobs in the United States for classics professors in 1979-80. My grandparents, my grandfather had just died, and my parents had jobs off the farm. They were living here, but they lived off the farm. So I had a twin brother, and he left the PhD program. And the two of us farmed along with a cousin, 180 acres. And I did that full time for almost 5 years. And then finally, when I got to be 29, the closest campus was Cal State University in Fresno. So I went up, and of course, they didn't want anybody with a PhD in classics, especially if he was a farmer. So they didn't quite believe me. I had no money. I was driving an old pickup truck. I wasn't well dressed. And they thought I was a con artist by saying I had a PhD in classics from Stanford. But they finally let me have one Latin class. And 20 years later, we had six full professors in classics in the whole program. And then at 49, I retired and went to the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and I've been there for 20 years. That sums it up.
Yeah. Dr. Hansen, thanks for sharing that. You know, as someone who came from a rural background myself, of a similar size community, it was a very much a cultural shock to come to a university, mm-hmm. but also a unique opportunity to do the type of learning that was never afforded to me at my high school, and learning that I actually really appreciated the humanities. So I think that's something that a lot of our students who would listen in would really appreciate hearing that background and that story.
It was definitely a new opportunity, and I tried to make the most of it. But culturally, it was hard that when you're 17, 18, 19, and mm-hmm. you're with a lot of very sophisticated people from the East Coast to Los Angeles, it's very wealthy people as well. So it was a shock.
That's awesome. Thanks. Well, speaking of the humanities, I was going to ask you kind of just about, in 2007, you were awarded a National Humanities Medal by President George W. Bush. And admittedly, I had to look up what that medal actually means, but it was really interesting just talking about, it's given to individuals or groups or institutions for their work basically on, the understanding of humanities and to help preserve and expand Americans' access to important resources. So I was just curious, what did it mean for you to get that award, both then, but also now, years down the road? Does it still impact the work that you do?
Well, I had kind of an interesting career in classics, in that I had some very good professors at Stanford, and they always said, you have an atypical background, and you're never going to know as much about the symphony or the opera or the fluent speaker of French or like a lot of the other students. But you do know farming, and the ancient Greeks were rural people, and we don't know anything about farming. So we make mistakes when we talk about Greek farming or agricultural life, but you probably won't. So we suggest you use your Greek and Latin classical learning, but at least start out. And I also had a lot of family members who were veterans of World War II, which I grew up with hearing about that. So in my thesis, it was on warfare and agriculture in classical Greek, or how people attacked agriculture during the war. And so after that, I decided to write things that were not just, they had to be scholarly, because I had been trained as a philologist, not an archaeologist or historian. And that just means we just had seminar after seminar in the Greek and Latin languages, how to write them, how to read manuscripts, how to study comparative philology and grammar, Latin and Greek. So within that context, I wrote a lot of books about the ancient world, the rural, the other Greeks was about the rural world, hoplite warfare, the Western way of war, and then I started to be interested in comparative things. I thought that I wanted to expand. So I wrote books like Carnage and Culture or The Soul of Battle or Savior Generals or books about military history throughout the ages, Civil War, World War II, World War I. But the common theme was I was trying to make scholarship available to the general reader. And it was very hard to do because when you write for a general reader, then you're attacked as a popularizer. But if you just stay in a very scholarly academic pose, then you're considered irrelevant or you're too narrow for the people to gain any access to your work. So there has to be a type of balance where you write for in a prose style that people can read, and yes, it has to be credible academically. And then when I was 49, that was 20 years ago, I began to write columns regularly. So I became a syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and I think I can say that I've never missed a column in almost 20 years. And I wrote for the National Review for 20 years. I never missed a column either. And now I still do the Tribune column and I write for American Greatness, and then I write for a website I have. So I'm writing about 4,000 or 5,000 words a week on contemporary things, but I also try to write one or two scholarly articles a year for either journals or magazines or academic publications. And then I try to write a book every 2.5 years. I just finished them. But literally just this week, the final edits from the editor. And so it's pretty busy. I think if I would look back, I wouldn't have done quite what I did in my life. I spent too much time, and I do to write academic work, and I would have relaxed a bit. It was very hard to be out in the middle of nowhere here, and I had a family, and then I had an extended family where I took care of my grandmother and my parents were on the farm, and siblings, nieces and nephews, and it was an actual working farm. So there was always a schizophrenic existence between scholarship and writing at Stanford or Cal State and then being out here where you had to, I'd get out of a Greek class at Cal State Fresno and drive, 35 miles fast as I could, get on a tractor and try to salt it out. It kind of became very jarring. As it is today, I'll be out here and then I'll drive 4 hours to Palo Alto on the Stanford campus, and everything is antithetical to the San Joaquin Valley as far as culture, economics, diversity, all that stuff.
Awesome. That's so cool to hear just about that kind of journey of your work.
Yeah.
I know that people always say it's not right to assume things, so you can let me know if this isn't true, but I'm guessing you get a little bit of criticism about your writings in commentaries. And I was just curious, how do you handle criticism, and has your approach to criticism changed through the years?
I guess you assume that because in the profession that I'm in, academia, in university sure. life, it's very left-wing, and center or center-right, maybe more conservative sometimes than that on certain issues. I've asked for it. I wrote a book called Who Killed Homer about the bankruptcy of academia. I wrote one called Mexifornia on what the perils were of an open border. That was 20 years ago. And I've written books on farming and corporate life, strangling small farms. So when you write those, you get a lot of... So I've been attacked by right-wing people who are defending corporate agriculture. I've been attacked by big farmers who want cheap labor. I've been attacked by left-wing academics. And so you have to get a... I try to have a philosophy, and it works like this. When somebody writes me a very critical letter, and I'm discounting all of the nut letters, I have a column on my website called The Angry Reader. And I have a scale. So I award people points. If they use all capital letters, that's a point. Or if they use more than 6 or 7 exclamation marks, if they misspell words, if they use scatological words, if they use the F word, if they have no evidence, if they are racist, anti-Semitic. I have all of it, and then I give them a score. That's kind of humorous. Some of them get very angry because if they put their name on an email to me, I will put the name on the Angry Reader. I don't, if they just have an email address, I don't put that on. I just put it in. So, and then you'll be places where people will either want to confront you, or they'll come up to you and say things like, I'm a student at Stanford. I wanted to read a book of yours, but my professors tell me you're crazy or you're nutty or I don't want to talk. I shouldn't talk to you. That kind of stuff. That happens a lot, actually, at Stanford. So you get a thin, you got to have a thick skin. And my getting back to what I said, you have to have a general philosophy that if you're in the arena and you are very critical, then you can't whine and say, oh my gosh, they're offended. You have to take your medicine and you have to do it in a dignified manner. You always have to think, what would I, when I write something about Joe Biden or Barack Obama that I have been critical in the past, I always have to say, if I were them, how would they react to this criticism? So I try not to use personal slander or gratuitous remarks. And I try to document. In other words, when people say that's not true, then I always document it and I double check it. I think in some 3,500 columns that I've written, I've only had to have one correction. And that was on a historical point. I think I wrote it too fast. So that helps. Every once in a while you err. I was on a major network and somebody asked me about Joe Biden's health. And I said he looked reptilian. And they thought that was over the and they said, how can you be so cruel that that's, but he did. He looked reptilian. And I tried to say I didn't mean it in a mean fashion. I was trying to be descriptive, but then later I felt I shouldn't have said that. That's one of the few times I regret. Although my wife said, that's exactly what he looks like. He doesn't have a lot of color. He doesn't have, he has skin and his hair, and the way he speaks reminds her of a lizard or something. But that was kind of gratuitous.
That's funny.
I appreciate that outlook. And yeah, at the Hounsdown Center, especially the Common Ground Initiative, we think about being intellectually curious. So yeah, it's also, I mean, when you then voice your thoughts, you spent the time to think about, and people have to take the opportunity to voice it, and you get to consume these intellectual ideas. You know, I think that's a gift. And I think that people are putting this information out there. They believe a certain way or subscribe to a certain philosophy or ideology. It's an opportunity to engage with ideas that you might think differently with. So thank you for your very wise and mature approach, because I think more people should hear that. We appreciate that approach.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah, I think I had no choice in a way. I had two parents that were, I guess you would, they don't exist anymore, but they were Truman or JFK Democrats, socially and culturally conservative, but politically populist. But then I'd say, and we have two first cousins whose mother died and they grew up with us. So there were five of us. And I would say now, thank God we're all still alive, but all four of them are left of center, and some maybe way left of center. So I grew up in a family where I was always the odd person out. Because since I was 18, I had political views that were different from my siblings and somewhat different than my parents, although we were very close. And so I think that was, I had to be very careful of what I said, because usually I get someone in the family saying, I can't believe you were on television or radio and you said that. That doesn't represent what this family believed. And so I was like,
that's awesome. Yeah, well, that, I'm excited to read some of The Angry Reader. I'm going to go and check it out. So my last question for you, this is a question that I end all of our podcasts with, and that is, if you were talking to someone who wants to do similar things that you do, you know, maybe write, be an author, be a historian, whatever it is in your career path, what advice would you give someone wanting to have a similar career as you?
I say two things. The first is you have to worry first about yourself and have to have a professional code. So I noticed very early on when I became not just a writer of books or articles or scholarly, but also popular columns, op-eds, and same thing with interviews, that you show up and you meet a deadline And when an editor suggests correction, you don't get angry and petulant. You try to professionally evaluate to what degree they're right. You can be helpful. You try to treat people professionally. So if somebody writes me and says, this is a book, I know it's 400 pages, I know you're busy, can you give me a blurb? I'll either have to say, I look and try to evaluate that professionally. Is it a good book? Would it be a good book? Should I read the book? How much time do I have to do a credible job? And if I can come to a conclusion that I can, then I write them back promptly and say, I will have it done in 12 days, 15 days. And then I try to adhere to that. And that gives you, I guess it gives you a reputation that if somebody calls you up and says, look, I'm in a jam, my speaker canceled, can you fly to Boston and give a lecture? Or this person never made a deadline, could you do an extra article? You get a reputation and that opens up venues and opportunities. Whereas if you get a reputation that you're angry at the editor or you're whiny or self-righteous or you turn stuff in late or you forget a deadline, then you're not going to have as many opportunities unless you're enormously talented. So that I think is very important. And that was something that I developed very early on. And then the other thing is being a writer requires, I don't want to say arrogance, but you have to have some self-confidence because you're going to be rejected. And sometimes the rejection is not coming on meritocratic values. And that can range from a peer review of an article you submit to a journal and you can tell from the comments who it is that they don't like you for reasons other than your scholarship. And you have to forget that. Or you can write one of the best books you've ever written and a publisher can write back and say, I don't think this will work. Sorry. And if you just pout and you have to, I know that I'll give you an example of what I mean. Where I work, there was an individual who, when I was being considered for a full professorship fellowship at Stanford, said, you'll never make it here. We don't hire people from Fresno. We don't hire people from Cal State. You're way out of your league. And rather than get angry about it, I would just say to myself, is there any validity to that? I went rural high school to UC Santa Cruz. I did well. I went from there to Stanford. I did well. I went to American school. Each time I went a step higher, I seemed to be okay. So I didn't get angry. And that same person, and then he saw me about a year ago. He said, wow, that was the best appointment. You're the best appointment I ever made. And he didn't make it, of course. But rather than remind him, you just sort of shrugged. So I think you have to get a thick skin and have confidence in your own power. And you have to have, I don't know if it's a religious feeling or philosophical, probably a mixture of both, but you have to feel that there is some force in the world, that if you play by the rules, certain cultures have different words for it. What comes around goes around, karma, nemesis, and classic Greek, but there is a general leveling out in the universe. I believe that. And then at some point when we're dead, we're all going to find out what it was really the plan, the divine plan behind it. But I really do believe that there is a sense of justice. And you want to be on the right side of that sense of justice. Not that you don't stray sometimes, but if you repeatedly and flagrantly do things that are unethical or unprofessional, I think it will catch up to you, and not just in the next world, but in this world. So I think that's very important for young people to not cut corners and not get depressed. If they can have a professional code of ethics and follow it, there will be eventually, in many cases, some recognition of that. And I think that's important to know. Okay. A lot of young people in graduate school will tell you, this person just obsequious, they're not very talented, they kiss up, they do all this. And you have to tell them, just worry about yourself, because at some opportune moment, you're going to get an opportunity and you have to seize the day. And so but I think that was important. I know when I was younger, I didn't quite believe that. It took me a few years to discover that. And I was very lucky because my parents were constant encouragement. You know, when I had a PhD from Stanford, and I was 25 printing lines with people every day from Mexico, and they would say to me, you're an idiot. Why'd you have to go to get all those stupid degrees when you're doing just what we are? We do it better than you do. And you had to deal with that. Because they had a point, didn't they? At least at the time.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of that. That is great advice. And thank you so much for answering all of our questions and just being willing to take the time to be on our podcast today. We are really excited for you to join the stage with Eric Liu for our event on September 7th. So for those of you listening to this podcast, more information about our event, which is called Citizenship in Crisis, Reempowering the American Citizen, is linked in the description below. But we are excited to see you in person, Dr. Hansen, in just a few weeks.
Thank you. I'll see you in a few weeks.
Thank you for listening to Off the Stage Podcast, a series produced by the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. The Hauenstein Center, inspired by Ralph Hauenstein's life of leadership and service, is dedicated to raising a community of ethical, effective leaders for the 21st century. For more information on our center, our Cook Leadership Academy, or our Common Ground Initiative, visit our website at www.gvsu.edu/hc. To keep up with our current events and reoccurring initiatives, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, all of which can be found linked below. If you liked this episode, consider giving us a review or rating so we can be found by other podcast listeners. Again, thanks for listening to Off the Stage Podcast.